Welcome to the Age of Napoleon. Dispatch 15. As always, I'd like to start by thanking you for your support. Without you, this show would not be possible. I'd like to start this installment with a few stray observations from last episode. First of all, I would like to congratulate the economist Thomas Piketty. Doing research for the last episode, I discovered that Piketty has become a member of a very exclusive club, with such august members as Charles de Gaulle, Victor Hugo, Charles Martel, Talleyrand, and Napoleon himself. The club of French people whose names are almost always pronounced phonetically in English by Americans. Obviously, some of that distinction has to do with the name itself, but I think it does indicate that a person has reached a certain level of fame in the English-speaking world. I can't think of another living French person to be so honored. On a more serious note, something else that caught my attention from last episode was Parisian crime statistics. I was expecting to find that Napoleonic Paris had a very high murder rate. Violent crimes like armed robbery and assault were much more common in Napoleon's capital than in any modern American city. It seems to have been very common for Parisians to have carried weapons. Police reports of the era are full of sword and knife fights. However, according to official records, the Paris murder rate was actually about 4 times lower than my hometown, Seattle, which is generally considered on the safe side for an American city. It's even more stark when you compare it to a more violent American city. The murder rate of Napoleonic Paris was apparently over 15 times lower than modern Memphis, Tennessee, for example. I chose not to include this particular statistic because I'm not quite sure how to interpret it. It may simply be a reflection of the weapons of choice of the criminals of Napoleonic France and modern America. It's a lot easier to kill people with a semi-automatic handgun than it is with a knife or a dagger. Then again, I also wonder if the official Paris homicide rate is an accurate reflection of how many people were actually murdered within the city. This was an era before modern state bureaucracy as we know it, and as we discussed in the episode, police methods were pretty rudimentary. I would imagine it would be much easier for a murder to go undetected in this environment. Murder victims are most commonly people at the margins of society. The type of people whose sudden absence might not be noticed, either by the state or by anyone inclined to report a crime. As we discussed, the death rate within the city was very high. Napoleonic Paris was an unsafe environment. People died all the time from disease, accidents, or any of a million other ways. In short, it seems like the perfect situation for murders to slip through the cracks and go unreported. And of course, just like today, the police would have had an incentive to downplay the number of unsolved homicides. Modern American police departments often come under criticism for so-called juking the stats, and from what we know, Napoleon's police were actually far less professional and scrupulous. So my guess would be that a lot of Parisian murder victims ended up buried in a lonely grave in the woods outside the city, and never appeared in the official statistics. But that's not much more than a hunch. On the other hand, while policing was much more rudimentary, so was crime. Today, there are massive international criminal networks worth billions of dollars. Particularly, but not exclusively, those tied to the drug trade. Studying this era, you don't really encounter criminal enterprises much more sophisticated than loosely organized networks of horse thieves and smugglers. Historical crime is not really my area of expertise. These are just a few stray thoughts. Maybe one of you can shed some light on this. Anyway, on to your questions. First, Colin Larson asked, did artillery regiment soldiers go deaf, and or are there cases of artillery misfiring or malfunctioning? How reliable was it, and considering Napoleon started off leading the artillery, did he prefer it over cavalry and musketry? The relationship between loud noises and deafness seems to have been only partially understood in this era. As I mentioned in our episodes on Trafalgar, gunners on Napoleonic-era warships did use ear protection. Even today, in depictions of sailors from this era, you often see them wearing cloth wrappings on their heads. These were to keep their earplugs in position. I've also read accounts of artillerymen in fortresses taking precautions to protect their ears. Particularly large cannon and mortars were equipped with very long lanyards, so the gunners could actually leave the room and fire the piece from some distance away. Some fortress guns were actually large enough that they could cause physical damage to the body if you happened to be standing nearby in an enclosed space when they were fired. However, it seems they were only aware of this problem with very large caliber guns in enclosed spaces, the sudden catastrophic hearing loss that can come from exposure to a very loud noise. The much slower cumulative hearing loss from repeated exposure to noise seems not to have been as well understood. As far as I know, the regular line artillery regiments took no precautions beyond covering their ears with the palms of their hands. I did a little research and was able to find one instance of a French captain being issued an ear trumpet after suffering hearing loss from combat, but it seems he was actually an infantry officer who happened to be standing near a mine when it exploded. Artillery malfunctions and misfires were a constant problem. When you get down to it, we're talking about a metal tube subjected to repeated controlled explosions under high pressure. The manufacturing techniques for both cannon barrels and gunpowder were imprecise, and the crews operating them were working under the stress of battle, and sometimes inexperienced. Good artillerymen knew how to take care of their guns, and knew the warning signs of a piece that might be nearing the end of its lifespan. Still, malfunctions were a fact of life in the artillery regiments, and they could be very dangerous. However, the cannon of the Napoleonic era were far safer and more reliable than anything that had been available in previous generations. We talked about this a bit in our early episodes, but artillery technology had improved by leaps and bounds over the course of the 18th century. This is a big reason Napoleon found the field so fascinating. As to the latter part of your question, there was a perception among some men of the Grande Armée that Napoleon showed favoritism to the artillery units. It has also been suggested by some that the Emperor's background in the artillery gave the officers and men of the artillery regiments a haughty attitude. On the other hand, I think almost all historians of this era would agree that Napoleon's use of artillery was generally extremely effective, which I think suggests he was using it judiciously rather than relying on it too much. I'm planning a future episode on the artillery and engineers, just like the ones we did in the past on the infantry and the cavalry. So we will be delving more deeply into these matters in the future, but hopefully this will tide you over until then. Next, Roman asked, how did Napoleon view corporal punishment? Did he still use the guillotine, or did he revert back to more traditional methods of execution? Napoleon was not a great believer in corporal punishment. The practice had been widespread in the army of the old regime, but had been abolished by the revolutionaries. Napoleon did not reinstate it. Generally speaking, he preferred positive reinforcement, the promise of rewards for good service. Flogging was still common in many European militaries of this period, but not the Grande Armée. Soldiers convicted of criminal infractions were usually simply imprisoned and/or transferred to labor battalions, where they did hard, inglorious work under tight supervision. Bonaparte did not really approve of corporal punishment, but he was not at all shy about capital punishment. As we've seen in past episodes, he could be merciless to soldiers who were caught looting or committing murder or rape. Soldiers of the Grande Armée were also famous, or perhaps infamous, for dispensing their own form of justice outside official channels. Men who caused problems or shirked their duties might be beaten by their fellow soldiers after an impromptu unofficial trial. Those who stole from their own comrades might even be murdered. Officers tended to look the other way. It was understood this was simply how these matters were handled, another one of the unwritten privileges retained by the soldiers. Within the military, the typical method of execution was, of course, the firing squad. Infamously, the revolutionary armies had sometimes taken guillotines on campaign with them, but these were to use on captured traitors. The guillotine was seen as an inappropriate death for a soldier, and besides, it was a cumbersome and sophisticated piece of equipment. It was a lot of trouble to carry around, assemble, and disassemble. Napoleonic France did continue to use the guillotine for civilian executions. Today, people sometimes think of the guillotine as something particularly sinister, almost like an instrument of torture, but it was seen very differently in the revolutionary and Napoleonic eras. The guillotine was a modern and even humane form of execution. Under the old regime, commoners were typically hanged. Hanging is a science. When done properly, death is almost instantaneous, and relatively painless. But that requires accurately measuring the condemned person, and carefully calibrating the gallows to their height and weight. Under the old regime, this was almost never done properly. Those executed by hanging typically died a slow, agonizing death, struggling helplessly as they were strangled. In some cases, they dropped with too much force, and their heads were actually pulled from their bodies. An excruciating and disgusting end. Nobles had been spared this ordeal. They were typically beheaded rather than hanged. However, this too sometimes went wrong. There was a good reason executioner was a skilled profession, not to be undertaken by just anyone. Theoretically, death by beheading was almost instant, but it was not uncommon for the executioner to miss his mark, or fail to sever the neck at the first blow, leaving the condemned screaming in agony and the executioner rushing to put them out of their misery. The guillotine was meant to put a stop to this, to allow the condemned to die with a minimum of pain and at least some modicum of dignity. This fit with the revolutionary ethos. Execution was meant to be a dispassionate expression of justice, not an act of retribution. Although at the height of the revolution, executions by guillotine became almost ritualized public spectacles. Napoleon maintained the guillotine, although without the theatrical trappings it acquired during the Terror. Pfluge asked, on hearing the question about black soldiers in Europe, I recalled seeing that the Napoleonic Kingdom of Naples supposedly had a regiment composed of people of African descent. Recalling it, I searched and found this name on Wikipedia, the 7th Regimento de Linea Reale Africano, and a note saying they hailed from Saint-Domingue, and were originally in the French service as part of the Corpo Reale Africano. I may be mistaken and do not know how credible the Wikipedia article for Neapolitan regiments is, but I thought I'd share it in case it is of interest to someone. Well, in the last dispatch, I said the American Legion was the only unit of primarily black soldiers that fought in Europe during the Revolutionary and Napoleonic Wars. That I knew of. But it looks like there were at least two. I've not been able to find much information on this Neapolitan regiment. They seem to have been much more obscure than their counterparts in the American Legion. My guess would be the Legion is much more well-known because it's associated with two famous characters, the Chevalier Saint-Georges and Alexandre Dumas, and because the Neapolitan army of this period is much less known and less closely studied than the French army. From what I can tell, almost everything written about this unit is in Italian, which I don't really speak. So if any of you out there know something about the 7th Regimento de Linea Reale Africano, please let us know. Next, Joe Waters asked, any books on Talleyrand you would recommend, preferably non-academic? I'm glad someone asked this, because I actually meant to include this recommendation in the last dispatch, but forgot. I would highly recommend Talleyrand by Duff Cooper. It is almost 100 years old now, published in 1932. So take it with a grain of salt, but it is a really wonderful book, very fun to read, and written in a kind of breezy but sophisticated tone that I think is very fitting for Talleyrand's character. Again, that's Talleyrand by Duff Cooper, D-U-F-F-C-O-O-P-E-R. Next, Jeff King asked, would a tall soldier automatically be put into the grenadiers, guards, or heavy cavalry units, or did they have to earn those spots? Generally speaking, the rule was soldiers had to earn their spots in any unit that received increased pay and/or special privileges. So in the case of the grenadier companies, the heavy cavalry units, and the guard, yes, the men had generally proven themselves to get those positions. Size was only one of several requirements for a position in these relatively privileged units. And it seems the height requirement was sometimes fudged a bit for particularly brave and talented men. Captain Jean-Roch Coignet, who we've quoted from in the past, was a member of a guards unit with a height requirement, but he often talks about his small stature in his memoirs. You might remember him from our episode on Tilsit, where he talked about looking like a child next to a Russian guardsman. According to Coignet, he was able to pass the height requirement thanks to a suggestion from Marshal Davout himself, who recommended he put playing cards in his shoes before he was measured. freshly raised infantry regiments would actually go into the field without grenadier companies, and only after being tested in battle would the officers designate the best and biggest men as grenadiers. Smaller men who had also proven themselves brave and reliable would be assigned to the Voltigeur Company to serve as light infantry. Next, White October asked, "Could you tell us about the French involvement in the First Serbian Uprising? We Serbs like to mention how Napoleon praised the Serbian leader Karađorđe, Black George. But what was the French reaction to the uprising in the Ottoman Empire, especially since it became France's neighbor via the Illyrian provinces?" To be honest, I have been puzzling over this question for quite a while now. The First Serbian Uprising is an extremely interesting story, and obviously an important moment in the history of the region. Karađorđe is a great character. As you point out, Napoleon himself thought so. But most English-language histories of the Napoleonic Wars simply ignore this event, or gloss over it in only a couple sentences. So I would like to include the First Serbian Uprising. I just need to figure out how and when to tie it into the main narrative. Sorry, I can't be more specific than that. I'd like to close out today with a long quotation. As some of you may be aware, we are currently passing the 225th anniversary of the events of the Great Irish Rebellion of 1798. We've discussed the great significance of this moment in past episodes, both to the European geopolitical scene of the time and to Irish and British history. I'd like to read the Declaration of the Society of United Irishmen of the City of Dublin, one of the most significant Irish patriotic groups of the era. Quote, "In the present era of great reform, when unjust governments are falling in every quarter of Europe, when religious persecution is compelled to abjure her tyranny over conscience, when the rights of men are ascertained in theory, and that theory substantiated by practice, when antiquity can no longer defend absurd and oppressive forms against the common sense and common interests of mankind, when all government is acknowledged to originate from the people, and to be so far only obligatory as it protects their rights and promotes their welfare, we think it our duty, as Irishmen, to come forward and state what we feel to be our heavy grievance, and what we know to be its effectual remedy. We have no national government. We are ruled by Englishmen, and the servants of Englishmen, whose object is the interest of another country, whose instrument is corruption, and whose strength is the weakness of Ireland. And these men have the whole of the power and patronage of the country as means to seduce and subdue the honesty and spirit of her representatives in the legislature. Such an extrinsic power, adding with uniform force in a direction too frequently opposite to the true line of our obvious interests, can be resisted with effect solely by unanimity, decision, and spirit in the people, qualities which may be exerted most legally, constitutionally, and efficaciously by that great measure essential to all prosperity and freedom of Ireland, an equal representation of all the people in Parliament. We do not here mention as grievances the rejection of a place bill, of a pension bill, of a responsibility bill, the sale of peerages in one house, the corruption publicly avowed in the other, nor the notorious infamy of borough traffic between both. Not that we are insensible of their enormity, but that we consider them as symptoms of that mortal disease which corrodes the vitals of our constitution and leaves to the people, in their own government, but the shadow of a name. Impressed with these sentiments, we have agreed to form an association, to be called the Society of United Irishmen, and we do pledge ourselves to our country and mutually to each other, that we will readily support and endeavor by all due means to carry into effect the following resolutions. Resolved, that the weight of English influence in the government of this country is so great as to require a cordial union of all the people of Ireland, to maintain that balance which is essential to the preservation of our liberties and the extension of our commerce. That the sole constitutional mode by which this influence can be opposed is by a complete and radical reform of the representation of the people in Parliament. That no reform is practical, efficacious, or just which does not include Irishmen of every religious persuasion. Satisfied as we are that the intestine divisions among Irishmen have too often given encouragement and impunity to profligate, audacious, and corrupt administrations, in measures which, but for these divisions, they durst not have attempted, we submit our resolutions to the nation as the basis of our political faith. We have gone to what we conceive to be the root of evil. We have stated what we conceive to be the remedy. With a parliament thus reformed, everything is easy. Without it, nothing can be done. And we do call on and most earnestly exhort our countrymen in general to follow our example and to form similar societies in every quarter of the kingdom for the promotion of constitutional knowledge, the abolition of bigotry in religion and policies, and the equal distribution of the rights of man through all sects and denominations of Irishmen. The people, when thus collected, will feel their own weight and secure that power which theory has already admitted as their portion, and to which, if they be not aroused by their present provocations to vindicate it, they deserve to forfeit their pretensions forever. Ordered that the former be printed for the use of members, James Napper-Tandy, Secretary. End quote. And yes, that is the same Napper-Tandy we talked about in a previous dispatch. So, if you wanted to join the society, you had to agree to this program, and then take an oath. There are several versions of the oath, but I'll read to you the one that was used in Belfast in the late 1790s, on the eve of the rebellion. Quote, "In the awful presence of God, I, Everett Rummage, do voluntarily declare that I will persevere in endeavoring to form a brotherhood of affection among Irishmen of every religious persuasion, and that I will also persevere in my endeavors to obtain a full, equal, and adequate representation of all the people of Ireland. I do further declare that neither hopes, fears, rewards, or punishments shall ever induce me, directly or indirectly, to inform on or give evidence against any member or members of this or similar societies, for any act of expression of theirs, done or made, collectively or individually, in or out of this society, in pursuance of the spirit of this obligation." End quote. All told, these are pretty moderate demands. It's a bit shocking to contemplate that the men who took this oath would soon be launching themselves against the muskets of the British army, armed with nothing but pikes. Anyway, that's all for now. As always, thank you for your support, and I'll be back to you soon with another episode from the main narrative.